Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind with Robin Pierce, Jessica Burtis, Pamela Sue Mann, Jonathan Lindsley, Jenny Bill, Alex Lefchuk, and more, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
In the final decades of the 21st century, men and women in rocket ships landed on the moon. By 2200 AD, they had reached the outer planets of our solar system. Almost at once, there followed the discovery of hyperdrive, through which the speed of light was first attained, and later greatly surpassed. And so at last, mankind began the conquest and colonization of deep space. United Planets cruiser C-57D, now more than a year out from Earth, back on a special mission in the planetary system of the great main sequence star, Altair. We need to follow them. We need to go for a Resonance Rewind. Robin, emergency cancellation Archimedes.
Indeed, the only phrase that can stop the mighty Robbie the robot. But if you think it can stop me, you have another thing coming. Right, Forbidden Planet. A lot to unpackage here because it's a little bit more complex and involved than your normal 1950s sci-fi movie fare. It's a big budget production, a movie actually made by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, who didn't make sci-fi movies at this point. And indeed, most sci-fi movies of this period were low budget B movies. It starred Walter Pidgeon, one of their top stars. Also headlining was Anne Francis and Leslie Nielsen, in a script that owes much to Shakespeare's The Tempest, and which foreshadows a lot of the themes and tone that would be revisited about 12 years later by Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry's original series. Okay, so it's the 23rd century. Mankind has moved out to colonize other planets. We can travel faster than light. All is good. However, one colony on the planet Altair 4 has fallen silent. and the United Planets space cruiser C-57D, under the command of Captain Adams, is actually sent out to investigate. As soon as they achieve orbit, they are warned not to land, but, you know, being 1950s, you know, strong, virile, swaggering space crew, they land anyway. They find that the entire colony has been wiped out, apart from Morbius and his daughter Altera. Now, Morbius is a little bit suspicious from the very start. For one thing, he has built himself a manservant robot called Robbie. He lives in a fabulous house. He has graciously buried everybody else, even though that their spaceship was actually vaporized by an unknown force. He is a philologist, meaning he studies languages, and he has been spending his time not only building robots, suspiciously, he has unearthed a huge cavern of the civilization that previously lived on Altair 4 called the Krell. Now, they were experimenting with what I can only call a brain booster, which will enhance your intellect. And he has enhanced his own intellect. Herein lies the problem. Not only has it allowed him to build Robbie as a mere plaything, he has also, unknown to him, expanded not only his ego, which is very present in the way he likes to run his planet like his own little kingdom, but his id, his dark half, his inner monster. And herein lies the real problem and the crux of the film, as the C-57D crew are repeatedly attacked by a strange, invisible force. Now, that's as much as I can put in a nutshell. As I say, we have a lot to unpackage tonight. Shall we get to it?
We had hoped to be joined by Gary Girani. Sadly, circumstances prevented him coming up, but he has actually named this as number one in his top 100 sci-fi movies. But let's turn to Jonathan, because I've gone through an interesting sort of switch of things on this particular system. Maybe it's because I'm viewing it now through 21st century eyes. What's your take on this Fred Wilcox system? Do you think he should have stayed with directing Lassie movies?
No, I actually quite enjoyed this movie. I have seen it before, and I enjoyed it for the performances and for spotting some of the people who were playing smaller parts who then went on to become a little bit more famous. I noticed, for example, a character called Strong in the movie was played by, is it James Jury, who went on to play the Virginian famously and became a worldwide star, but only had about eight lines in this movie. couple of conversations about the electric fence, I remember. But all in all, I thought this was quite an intelligent attempt at understanding some interesting themes in life. One is, you know, a father who is jealous of his daughter getting involved with somebody else. So the love aspect of this film I found fascinating, quite interesting. It's very American in that sense. Also, the militarization of the crew, which I think Robin is absolutely right. It did foreshadow something, some of the elements of Star Trek, in which they all called, you know, the crew. There was a doctor, there was a commander who clearly was the leader, but there was also a kind of a mouthy lieutenant, which I suppose could have morphed into Spock at some point, you know, who was always questioning the commands. So I thought it was interesting in that sense, I mean, in terms of human relations. And I liked Robbie the robot. I liked the fact that he could run up different dresses for the daughter, who seemed to wear several outfits. In fact, she seemed to have a new outfit for every scene that she played in. And I thought it was interesting that she got told off for wearing too revealing an outfit, but didn't know what a swimming costume was. And then at a later date, she had the robot run her up a dress that covered everything, but she only wore it once and then went back to extremely short dresses, which showed everything. So it was quite interesting in that sense. Very attractive young lady. Liked Walter Pidgeon. Thought he was a good actor. He never quite made it, did he, as a big star? I thought, I remember, like in Mrs. Miniver, he didn't quite get the Oscar. I think he got. Did he get nominated for an Oscar? I think he did. But overall, I think I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed Leslie Nielsen. Although what happened with Leslie Nielsen, who played the commander in this, later on went to do the Naked Gun series and all the send-up movies. So I kind of kept expecting Leslie Nielsen to do something quite funny, but he never did. Really, he was a bit too serious for me in this. But overall, I thought it was a good movie and I enjoyed it. And I think it was made in the year of my birth. So I probably didn't see it when it first came around. But 1956, was that right? Yeah, so it's now 66 years old. And I thought it wore quite well, to be honest with you. I thought some of the special effects, and I actually would like to mention some of the sound effects, which I thought were really quite clever. I liked some of the electronic sounds that I heard. Because there was no music, was there, in this movie? It was all electronic sound effects and footfalls and things like that. When they, which I thought was very brave, because when you think about movies of that period, they nearly always had some sort of soundtrack, and this was an electronic sound effect driven movie, which I thought was fascinating. So I enjoyed that as well. So that's kind of my take on this movie.
Louis and Baby Baron, of course, for responsible for the electronic tonalities. You can't run around like that in front of men. 18 competitively selected super perfect specimens with an average age of 24.6 years. I ought to have you locked up in hyper. They've been locked up in hyperspace for 378 days. Just goes to show, obviously, the response that white Americans actually had at that time. Jessica, let's turn to yourself. Forbidden Planet, the first time you've seen this, or have you caught it before?
Yeah, so I hadn't really known what this was. I thought it was a TV show. And then I was like, oh, it's a movie. And then I really started reading about it. And this movie premiered in my city in 1956. My city. And that's so unusual because nothing happens here. That was really cool. And I really want to talk to my godmother because she was living. She grew up in Charlotte and she would have been born before this came out. So I'm very curious if she went and saw this as a teenager. I thought this movie was so incredible. It had so many firsts. Like, it was the first to have a soundtrack like this. And it was the first to feature faster than light travel. It was the first to be filmed on an entirely alien planet. It had the creator of the robot from Lost in Space also made the robot in this. It was filmed on the set of the Wizard of Oz poppy fields. And it inspired Star Trek and inspired a lot from Star Wars. Like, this movie had such an impact, and that's what I find incredible about this. And I had always thought Star Wars was kind of like the genesis of a particular type of aesthetic for space movies. And I realized when I watched this, a lot of the sets in Star Wars remind me of the industrial sets in this. And it made so much sense. And yeah, the effects, like Jonathan mentioned, were incredible. I was just shocked that this was made in 1956 and it has this caliber of effects, and just the cleverness that they used painted backgrounds, but they used animation to make it seem 3D and make it seem real. That's so clever. And I love how the soundtrack was so different. And I didn't know that before this, like, sci-fi movies had kind of been considered, like, usually, like, sci-fi movies like this were like B movies. They were like movies that would get disregarded, and this kind of made the genre get taken more seriously. So I feel like I can't believe I didn't know more about this and the impact it had. And I want to read the novelization now because I didn't know they made a novel based off the movie. But yeah, I think more than like the characters, although the characters are very interesting, and I think Morbius is a very interesting antagonist because there wasn't like a dastardly villain in this. There wasn't like some enemy that they were like plotting, setting out to just do absolute destruction. It was more about the subconscious and human nature and questions of that. And are humans inevitably, like, is there this inevitable part of us where we will always be consumed by our own hubris? And that's really something that's interesting to discuss, especially now in a world where we have weapons for war that can really cause mass destruction. But yeah, it was really great. I really enjoyed it.
equivalent of 9,200 thermonuclear reactors in tandem. That's quite a power source to actually furnish your monsters from the id in what could be argued as a precursor to the Wi-Fi age, basically, a civilization without instrumentality. Astounding. Jenny Bill. So far, eulogizing from Jessica. Obviously, if it I hadn't realized it premiered in Charlotte, but there we are. That's great stuff. That proved that the connection was all working there. And obviously, the year of Jonathan's birth. What can you bring to the party in terms of Forbidden Planet?
I have seen the film before, and I actually think it's really hard for us now to look at it and realize what an innovative film and groundbreaking film it was, because I've seen it before and I watched it, and obviously I don't really like the female character, I think, you know, and I don't really like the cook, you know, the bit of humor, and I think but it was very typical of the female characters of that day. But if you brought that female character and you put her into something today, she wouldn't look out of place. I mean, the clothes, I mean, for them to have the daring, actually, to have her wearing such revealing clothes at that time in a film where it wasn't really a popular genre at that time. I absolutely love the music, and I think the acting is really, really good. Leslie Nielsen, yes, he does do all the sort of comedy things, but he did start as a serious actor, and I think he's excellent in this. And, you know, and the special effects are excellent. The whole thing, and just the pacing of it, everything is really, really good. But as I say, I think that the main thing is that it's really hard for us to realize that at that time, what an amazing film. It still looks amazing. And at that time, it was even more amazing, you know, because it's even older than me. It's the same age as Jonathan. And that's not often that a film is looks that good, that's that old.
Interesting. Again, some of the lines, and one which always makes me smile, maybe it's just my tendency to occasional adolescent humour, is, of course, the classic from presumably either Marvin Miller or Freddie Darrow as Robbie the Robot. Sorry, miss, I was giving myself an oil job. To me, but then again, a commanding officer doesn't need brains, just a good loud voice. You've heard the initial scene setting then, Robin. Clearly it seems as though Forbidden Planet, Fred Wilcox looking down from above, because he didn't live much longer after this, of course, passed away I think 5 or 6 years afterwards. Any response?
Well, let me tell you a story. It was 1983 that I first saw this on television. I'd read a lot about it, but it was 1983 on, I think, BBC Two showed a season of sci-fi movies early on in the year, just after I'd bought my first VHS recorder. And this was among them. And I made sure that the recorder was recording. And, you know, thank Asimov I did that, because that was the year that Return of the Jedi would be released in the summer. And I was absolutely blown away by Forbidden Planet. And it was shown in February. I think it was the last one of that season that they showed before my birthday. And I always tend to watch this film around that time. So this is the second time I've watched it this year. And I couldn't help but notice that some of the effects in Forbidden Planet were every bit as good as Industrial Light and Magic were providing for the much larger budgeted Return of the Jedi at that time. And they still stand up today because I have it on Blu-ray and the transfer is just vivid and gorgeous. It's a 1950s film and it's got a 1950s design aesthetic in many ways. And one of the things about the only thing that I find unfortunate about the film is that you do have rampant, cringeworthy, misogynistic dialogue on behalf of particularly, now, is it the chief when they meet Morbius for the first time and he's hitting on Altera? And when he was giving these lines of dialogue, I was inwardly cringing, like, dude, just stop it. Then I realized that her hard-faced naivete was actually shooting him down very effectively, something that you didn't see done much in that time. Because normally you'd get the swaggering He-Man, you know, throughout a line that would make me die inside if I ever said it. And, you know, usually the woman would flutter her eyelids and go, oh my, you know, but in this, she gave as good as she got. Even when he tried to kiss her, she says, nah, didn't feel anything. Do you want to try again? You know, I just thought the whole thing was absolutely amazing. I like the look of it. I like the fact that she countered every one of his advances. I like seeing Leslie Nielsen in a serious role because as far as I can remember, the first time I ever saw Leslie Nielsen was actually on the old early 70s Kung Fu show with David Carradine, where he played kind of a recurring villain in a few episodes, or it might have been a two or three parter. So seeing him in this pre-Airplane and stuff like that was really, really kind of refreshing. And you see the breadth of his talent. Robbie the Robot, you know, most people would have believed at the time that it was an actual functioning robot because even though he was anthropomorphized, he didn't look like he could have anybody inside him. And pretty much because of the design that was provided by Robert Kinoshita, also for the robot B9 in Lost in Space. You know, it's hard to figure out how an actor could be in that because he seems so transistorized and there are so many things going on in that big dome head, the flashing lights and everything like that. So it's just perfect. If we did like a Desert Island Discs kind of thing, this would be going on the island with me. Absolutely. No question.
Fine technician, good shipmate. That's a good epitaph for any man. Maybe it's because I sort of was reminded of much of the kind of 1950s science fiction, the like of Robert Heinlein and so on. I felt there were borderline areas here that kind of were pushing too much down the line of what would be argued these days as being a little bit fascistic, but that's by the by, in terms of us, they really not a single, you know, all white, all male in terms of the crew that's actually there. A little bit disappointing, although again, maybe that's another issue for another time. Jonathan, again, it seems as though there's lots of positivity about this side of things there. And Anne Francis, of course, her miniskirt was responsible for Franco in Spain actually banning this movie for 10 years. So it wasn't allowed to actually be seen in Spain until 1967. Because clearly the sight of bare legs from a female's point of view, quite, you know, obscene. Exactly, Jenny, obscene. Jonathan, anything else you'd like to add at the moment before we start talking about characters and so on?
I think it's interesting that Franco thought that bare legs would inflame the Spanish passion, which is quite intriguing. But no, actually, there's some quite interesting things. Again, what Robin said about the, I think it was the lieutenant who came on to the daughter in a big way, and with some of the cheesiest lines about coffee I've ever heard, and also later on when he was kissing her. But what I thought was really interesting about that was that, like in a lot of movies, he got his comeuppance by being killed, which I thought was quite quite interesting. So the writers wiped him out after that. So and he gave a lot of kind of significant looks at Leslie Nielsen, who I don't know whether I missed a bit of this film or whether I just coughed and turned my, but I didn't really see the moment where she fell in love with Leslie Nielsen. I saw when she was hating him and having a go at him about a fight. And then suddenly she was deeply in love with him. And I found that a little bit hard to swallow or difficult to believe, really. But that would be my only criticism of that section of the film. And also I thought the young lady who played the part was great. I thought she really did a fantastic job faced with that kind of role. I keep saying this, I think I've said this on several occasions now, but it must have been very difficult for actresses who were aware of the sexism and must have understood that they were being given these roles. And they must have found it very difficult to therefore play kind of these simpering women or the difficult women or the innocent women or whatever it was they were asked to play, because they would have been much more kind of aware of what was going on in the world and how feminism was developing at later time in the 60s and then into the 70s. So I kind of always lost in admiration for the actresses who managed to carry off those roles. So I again, going back to that, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very watchable. I said this a couple of weeks ago, actually. Sometimes watching things for this show is a bit like doing homework. But in this particular case, I found it very entertaining and enjoyed it a lot. So and the time flew by. I mean, how long was the movie? About an just over an hour and a half. 98 minutes, yeah. And it didn't seem to drag at all for me. I thought it kept my interest all the way through. There was something. I even liked the animals. I liked the fact that there were some deer and a tiger on the thing. And I know the effects. There was a split screen, wasn't there, where the tiger jumped down when it first appeared, and you kind of lost the tiger's leg in the split screen. But even that I forgave, because I thought, you know, it was very brave. There were lots of brave moments in this film, a lot of film technique that was used and thrown at it, and I really enjoyed those things technically.
Well, speaking of brave moments, I think that one of the more courageous things they did, albeit very subtly, was in the depiction of her sexual awakening. Like, when we first see her, she has control of the animals, but as she's kind of falling for the good gallant captain, she loses that ability. So, you know, that again plays into mythology. And the other thing that I hadn't really thought of until I saw a documentary where Steven Spielberg, of all people, pointed out, because it's one of his favorite films, with a brain booster, where they check, you know, your actual intellect, and of course the doctor can sort of get this thing, this dial to raise, and the good captain can't. And, you know, it's all about the captain can't get it up. I'm just going to leave that there. But that's what Spielberg says. And I'm not going to argue with Steven Spielberg.
So, Jessica, we'll come to you at this particular stage. I mean, clearly there is a Shakespearean bent as well to this, in terms of we are such stuff as dreams are made of, and monsters of the id and the aspects relating to that. Who, in terms of characters, struck you as being somebody you'd like to have a coffee with, whether it be the captain or Cookie, or indeed Richard Anderson, of course, Oscar Goldman in The $6 Million Man, and his technician when he was putting together the Klystron device?
I mean, of course, it's the robot. He was great. I thought he was, you know, the star of the show, even though in the original poster, he looks like he's evil. He looks like an evil robot. but I also liked Altira, because I feel like her character had so much potential. And she was clearly very well educated, and she said as much. And she had been living on this planet with a complete experience, unlike any other human being who got to grow up like that. And I think that her character had so much potential. And I do think it's unfortunate that, like, quite a lot of her character was unexplored due to the sexism. And, you know, I for one loved her outfits. I thought they were so whimsical and sci-fi and beautiful. And I was really sad just to see, like, you know, she was living completely fine doing her own thing on this planet before these dudes showed up, and suddenly her outfits weren't okay. But
and the planet blows up and she loses her father. But it's okay because she's at least kept the robot and she's got a captain who likes her.
Yeah, I think she'd be very interested to have like a conversation with, if you could talk with the character and really understand like more about her, because I feel like that's such an interesting backstory, that growing up on an alien planet as like one of two humans there, that's so fascinating to be able to like control animals. Like, I feel like her character was the most interesting one, but again, I feel like it was just very unexplored, for obvious reasons that every movie from the 50s seems to have.
Well, clearly, Jessica, you must actually write that backstory and actually put it into place.
Yeah.
Much better than a musical Return to the Forbidden Planet, but there we are. And so one vote for the robot. Jenny, what about yourself and characters?
I think the character that was played by Leslie Nielsen, I think, was my favourite. I mean, he was in it for most of the film, and I actually thought he acted really well. As Robin said, you got to see a whole other side of Leslie Nielsen. And and I actually liked the way the character kept a kind of a control, and he held it all together. And I mean, he held all the men together, and didn't kind of, and as an actor, he never really overdid it. He just, he played it all quite finely, I thought. So yeah, that was my favourite character. Yeah,
he held all the 18 competitively selected super perfect specimens with an average age of 24.6 together. JJ Adams, of course. What did the JJ stand for? Like Doc Ostrow. And what was Morbius's first name? These are Edward. The unanswered questions.
He was Edward Morbius.
And a philologist. Robin, was Morbius the winner for yourself?
How did you know that? Actually, if you'd have asked me pre-1996, I'd have said Robbie the Robot. In 1996, I became parent to a daughter. And as the years went on, I got Morbius more and more. You know, you feel a level of protection towards your kids of either gender. But you feel a little bit more protective of a daughter, especially when the young men start coming round and you realize that
18 of them, Robin, perfectly physically perfect specimens all at once.
I'm not going to go into numbers here, but she's married now. And, you know, on the time when she got married last year, I mean, you know, it became very apparent to me that my role as her protector was changing. I was a little bit less kind of relevant, and in my viewings of Forbidden Planet this year, this is what I've seen in Morbius, and I thought, I've always had a sneaking admiration for him, and this time I was thinking, now I truly get where it is you're coming from. I absolutely get it. I understand fully. And it actually added to kind of my enjoyment of the film. I would, however, love to have a cup of coffee with him to see which one of us is raging id is the darkest. I vote me.
Thank you.
So one vote for Morbius, one vote for J.J. Adams, one vote for Robbie the Robot. Jonathan, are you going to affect this tiebreaker in any way, shape or form?
I'm not sure, actually, because I enjoyed a lot of the characters in this, but I kind of, most memorably for me was the Doctor. I actually quite liked the Doctor. I liked his performance. I thought it was very subtle. And he was very supportive, but very knowing. He spotted the love affair going on. He spotted the lieutenant trying it on too much. Didn't really do a lot, except that right at the end, he was extremely heroic and went off and plugged himself into the IQ improver. And it killed him. But not before he sussed out what the problem was and solved the entire plot of the film, basically, by explaining, having had his ego boosted, having had his IQ boosted, he understood that the villain was really the id of the evil, Morbius's evil side. So I thought overall, my vote goes for the Doctor.
After a million years of shining sanity, they could hardly understand the power that was destroying them, offered contrite Dr. Morbius. It's a sad bit of irony that we less advanced humans can figure out their problem, and partially because of the moral lesson dramatised in Forbidden Planet. I think I probably actually echo Jonathan's point in terms of Doc Ostrow. I did feel that he's one of the few folk there who wasn't immediately smitten by Alter, didn't wolf whistle, and seemed to be actually getting on with the job. But I also would put a nod in the direction of Technician Quinn, I believe, played by Richard Anderson, because, again, I thought all he was doing was putting together a Klingstron transmitter, and that's all he was trying to do, and he did it successfully, and, again, obviously he was killed as a result of that. So
I did, however, feel sorry for the poor guy who kind of half woke up during the first attack on the ship, and he had to pull 20 extra watches just for thinking it was a dream. I mean, poor guy.
Yeah. On the other hand, the cookie, who basically played by Earl Holliman, long before he actually took part in the first edition of Twilight Zone and Where Is Everybody, he effectively was drunk on duty, albeit without a hangover, given no punishment whatsoever.
Yeah, but you never ever cross the people who handle your food.
Mm. So let's go to scores then. Jonathan, what's your mark out of 10 for Forbidden Planet?
Oh, I'm going to give this a 10 for its period and for its time. I'm giving it 10 because I couldn't really fault it.
I first saw it probably back in the early 1970s, late night on Tyne's television, in black and white, clearly at that stage. And I thought it was interesting then. Saw it again, obviously, in latter years. I think I saw it once on the big screen at the National Film Theatre. It does work well. It's adjusted itself nicely over the years. I'm afraid, though, that it probably comes at a 9 for me. It's not an absolutely perfect movie for me. It's a 9 out of 10. Jessica, what's your score?
I feel like I have to give it a 10 because of just the sheer impact that this had on the sci-fi genre of movies like Star Wars, Star Trek. So many of the important pillars of sci-fi entertainment would not be what they are without this movie. And I feel like that's very important. Of course, there's an asterisk that the sexism is obviously makes it hard to watch sometimes. But I feel like it's a 10 because it's so important. It's so important. I didn't even know.
And it premiered in Charlotte.
Yes, exactly. Get some 11 just for that.
That too.
Yeah.
Jenny.
I agree with you, Alex, that it is not a perfect film. However, if I was giving the soundtrack a score, I'd give it 20 out of 10. And there are so many great things about it that I still think it deserves a 10 out of 10.
And Robin, presumably it'll be a straight 10 for yourself.
Oh, absolutely. It is a perfect film for me on every level. I mean, I watched it this morning. I could walk over to the other side of the room, watch it again right now, and I would be perfectly happy.
There we have it. The Forbidden Planet.
I have to ask, what is it you're not very fond of with this that doesn't make it a perfect 10?
It has been a 10 in the past, but at certain stages it's dropped as low as an 8. And overall, it's kind of settling that down at a sort of 9 now, to a 9, possibly 9.5 because of the Charlottesville thing. There's just something that, in a sense, I probably preferred the message of the day the Earth stood still 5 years earlier to this in terms of the actual text that was actually there. But it may go back to a 10. Who knows? Time is relative as we jump into the whole sort of system that's actually there. Also, I didn't quite like that. What a bounce through hyperspace. When they actually went into the beam systems. I thought, surely they'd be more sophisticated than that, but never mind. And they do actually say in the introduction, as we said, that so at last, in the final decades of the 21st century, men and women in rocket ships landed on the moon. So they've already identified this. So why did you actually have an all-male crew when you actually said in your introduction that men and women in rocket ships landed on the moon?
You had men and women in the colony because Morbius married one of them.
Yes. So why were they not present in on Starship C-57D?
Perhaps because of all the testosterone that was flying around among the male members of the crew. There would have been like loads of children born on the year's journey, wouldn't there?
It would have been a multi-generational ship.
The Forbidden Planet.
The issue that Star Trek was faced with. It would have been, you know, it's almost as though there would have been a lot of fooling around going on up there, which brings us full circle to Gene Roddenberry. Anyway, enough of such stuff, because that's obviously looking at a very sort of heterosexist perspective as well. Next week, we still keep romance in the air. We still actually explore the id. We go to a show which actually Jessica's already seen because she watched it by mistake a year or so ago when she thought she was watching another episode entirely. It's the Outer Limits 1980s version, not Demon with a Glass Hand, but the Outer Limits version, and the episode is entitled Mind Over Matter, with Mark Hamill, no less. Mark Hamill in a post-Luke Skywalker role.
It's an interesting episode, I can tell you guys from experience.
Until that time when we explore what it's like to actually download your consciousness into a computer and connect in all sorts of ways with Mind Over Matter, we simply say, Jonathan Lindsley, Jenny Bill, Jessica Burtis, and Robin Pierce, keep on resonating. And Robin, are you off to give yourself an oil job now?
How dare you, sir? How dare you?